Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is mastering engineer Gene Grimaldi. But first, let's talk about the seven-year rule. I don't know if you know about this, but in California, there's this interesting law called the seven-year rule. And what it means is, if you're under contract for personal services, like a record deal, for instance, your employer can only hold you for 7 years to that contract, and then you're free to go. Now, this came about in response to another law that was enacted way back in 1872, which is basically there to protect the entertainment business, which was just getting going in Los Angeles at the time. And what that law did was basically say that if you signed to a film studio, and that's what this was trying to protect, if you signed to the film studio, they would have your services forever, or until they didn't want you anymore and they fired you, and you had nothing to say about it. This was a pretty widespread law, and that it actually even applied to sports, for instance, and it was called in baseball the reserve clause, basically meaning if you signed to a major league team, they had your services until they didn't want you anymore. Well, in 1940, Olivia de Havilland, who was one of the co-stars of Gone with the Wind, actually took this to court and won a ruling that basically said, look, this is illegal, and after 7 years, the artist, the actor, the member of a sports team, all can walk away. So how does that apply? Well, this past week, something interesting happened around the seven-year rule. The band Avenged Sevenfold put out a new album on Capitol Records. And Warner Brothers, their previous label, sued them and is going to take them to court. The reason why? Well, in order for Avenged Sevenfold to be able to sign with Capitol, they waited until the end of the 7 years, and then they said, guess what? Seven-year rule, we're opting out. There's this little amendment that came around in 1989 that the record labels really pushed. Basically, what it says is, no problem if you want to get out at the end of 7 years, but if you were signed for 5 albums and you didn't deliver all 5, then the record label can come back at you and ask for damages. And that's just what happened here. Avenged Sevenfold said at the end of 7 years, guess what, we're out of here. And Warner Brothers came back and said, well, wait a second, you owe us another album. So the remedy for this by the courts is to get money. But since this has never actually gone to court, even though many actors and many sports figures and many artists and record labels and talent agents, for that matter, have been involved in this for a really, really long time, it's never actually gone to court. So now the interesting thing is, on Friday, this last Friday, Avenged Sevenfold put their new album out called The Stage. And now Warner Brothers is looking very, very closely to see how much revenue that brings in order to figure out how much they're going to sue Avenged Sevenfold for. In the meantime, Avenged Sevenfold says, we don't owe you anything because we opted out of our contract. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens here. This is going to go to court in 2017 sometime, and it's going to set a precedent, and we'll see how this affects record label deals going forward. But anyway, if you didn't know about the seven-year rule, it's something that's only happening in California, but it cuts both ways. Sometimes it's good for an artist, and sometimes it isn't. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my new Music Producer Formula course, as well as my other online video courses at bobbyosinskicourses.com. For more on my music industry and music production blogs, you can just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, where you can also read excerpts from my books. Now let's talk about evaluating speakers. I was just at AES, and wow, there are so many good monitors around. It seemed like no matter where you were going in the show, you were always hit with some really great sound from a different speaker manufacturer. Which brings up the case, how do you evaluate studio monitors? Well, there's actually a couple of things that you can do to evaluate them. There's 3 things, actually. The first thing is, when you're listening to monitors, and again, that's the key, you can't really figure this out unless you're listening to a monitor. You can't buy it because somebody else is using it, because you'll just never know. And usually you wind up being disappointed. The first thing is play something and listen to see if there's any holes in the frequency response, especially somewhere around the crossover network, which could be around 2K, and it could be if it's a three-way 2K and 5K, 2K, 7K, somewhere in there. But if there's a hole, certainly that's not good. There's always going to be one, but it shouldn't be so bad that you can hear it or that it makes a difference in your listening enjoyment. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you should be able to have the same frequency response regardless of what level you play back. So whether it's just at a whisper level or at a roaring volume, it should basically sound the same. And anywhere in between, of course. And many monitors aren't like that. They'll sound great up loud and they'll fall apart when you take them down low, or vice versa. So that's a really big thing. And then the third thing is, sometimes you have to play loud. And will they go loud enough? Is there a limiter built in? Most powered speakers these days do have limiters, but the fact of the matter is, sometimes they just stop the monitor from getting as loud as you might need. Now, speaking of loudness in monitors, I've noticed a couple of things, and kind of going way back to Alan Side's original studio monitors that I remember he built for A&M in their mixing room, and this is back in the early 80s. And these things were custom made, basically built around these old RCA theater horns, which they don't make anymore. They haven't made for probably 50 years. And he would just go around the country looking for these things. And between that and a custom high-frequency horn, it was a multi-cell horn that he was using as well, and different amplifiers. The amplifiers he liked to use were Crown DC-300s, where you don't see those anymore, and Yamaha 2200s, which you don't see those anymore either. But the sound was fabulous. It never got loud, it only got bigger, which is something that I notice with a lot of big monitor systems. If you turn up a big monitor system and it just seems to get louder and louder, then it's not doing what it's supposed to. In a really good sounding room and a really great monitor system where everything is tuned just right, you'll find that you can turn that level up and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger sounding, and doesn't sound louder, it just sounds bigger. Because there's basically no distortion in it. It just sounds wonderful that way. So the next time you go to buy monitors or even listen to monitors, just check out those things that we're talking about. When you start to turn it up loud, does it get loud or does it get bigger sounding? Do the monitors sound basically the same at any volume level? And when you listen, can you hear holes in the frequency response? My guest today is Gene Grimaldi, who's the chief engineer at Oasis Mastering in Burbank. Gene's credits include Lady Gaga, Nicki Minaj, Carly Rae Jepsen, will.i.am, and Neo, among many, many others. Gene is unique among mastering engineers as he began his career in the manufacturing side of the business, which you'll hear him discuss in the interview. Oasis is owned by the great Eddie Schreier, who has a ton of major music credits to his name as well. I spoke with Gene live at his studio in Burbank. I know we talked about this in lots of early interviews, but for the people who haven't read those or heard those or anything, let's talk about your background and how you get into the business back in the Philly area.
Oh, yeah. I went to recording school in around 1982, Institute of Audio Research. It was like, I think I started 83, maybe. And my mom's from that area. And I, that whole past two summers, I was doing electrical work. You know, assistant contractors in my area in Pennsylvania. And I thought I was going to be an electrician. So, you know, my true hobby was in, you know, audio though at the time. And, you know, I'm asking all these electricians, hey man, you know about RMS power and all this and that, you know? And they're like, yeah, no, we don't know anything about that. You know, it's like, I said, all right. So, I was tired of digging ditches, so I went to recording school, you know, and was taught by Al Grundy and some other great teachers that I can't
remember. Al Grundy's one of the pioneers, actually, in that.
I remember that.
And that was one of the first recording schools anywhere, as I recall.
Yeah, I really, at that time, I didn't know his background other than when I sat with him, you know, he liked my grades because you needed a mathematic background back then to get in because, you know, they were teaching more theory on you know, levels on how to get maximum levels, you know, because of the way the 600 ohm circuitry was back then, you know. So it was all about gain stage and level, which was kind of neat, you know. And, you know, at least I had that from you know, my high school. I had a technical trade school where I was learning electrical theory, you know, and they taught us all that stuff back then.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was like a year and a half. About a year and a half of schooling, and then, you know, I thought about that NYU music program that they had to get a bachelor's in music, you know, for, you know, maybe an instrument like piano or guitar or something. But I just went right into the studios there, just interning, you know. And
you did some live sound too, right?
Once I left the New York area, I went back to Pennsylvania. You know, I wasn't even 20, you know, I was probably 20 at that time. And I started doing some live sound, you know, in some of the smaller nightclubs in the area, you know.
Sure, yeah.
And they were liking what I was doing, you know.
Yeah.
So, and I did that for a while, and then I got a lead on a position at Sony in Pittman, New Jersey at the pressing plant. And I got hired, you know, for a gig, audio guy, you know. So I got to see the back end of, basically I learned from the probably quality control and pressing side. And then I worked my way back, you know, to the studio side.
Yeah.
So, which was a good learning for me, you know, and a good experience for you know, getting into mastering, you know.
Yeah, well, when you got there, so it was like what, 84, 85 somewhere?
I think I got hired at Sony around 85. Yeah,
okay.
85. I was there 85 till about 90.
So CDs had just started in 82, so you were right on the beginning of it.
Yeah.
Were they still pressing vinyl, too?
They just did their last pressing, and it was a box set, Bruce Springsteen box set. I don't remember which one it was, exactly the title of it, but that was the last one. And it was a big open warehouse. They were just moving all those vinyl pressing machines out of there and bringing in these German CD pressing machines.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, the replicators, yeah.
Yeah, they were big, you know, that whole thing.
How long were you there for?
About 5 years.
Oh, really? That long?
Yeah. I came out to California on vacation, and I just said, man, I got to go out there.
Yeah.
Sent some resumes out and hooked up at Future Disc, you know, and then I worked with Steve Hall, Eddie Schreier, and Tom Baker. I was a production engineer and, you know, slowly getting gigs.
Well,
you know,
let's talk about that for a second. Talk about production, because people don't know what that is anymore. It's kind of gone.
Yeah. Because back then, you know, there were formats, lots of formats. There was vinyl, cassette, CD, possibly some newer stuff, but it never made it. You know, the Philips cassette machine, the DATs. You know, never made DAT masters here in the United States, I don't think. I think that was more a Japanese thing. But and the Philips digital cassette never really took on. So, but, you know, production was busy, man. It was just busy. You know, lots and lots of masters. Many copies, tape copies for the vaults of the record labels. And
what kind of tape copies?
It was like quarter inch reels.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
I didn't realize you did that.
We did quarter inch reels for some of them. They requested, you know, analog tape copies of the digital masters now, you know, so, but, you know, everybody wanted a couple 1630s, you know, for their copies. Never mind all the plants. There were many plants back then. You know, I think some of the record labels, you know, there were a lot of record labels that had multiple plants, and then they contracted out to that. There were some bigger independent ones that they did a lot of work for. So, you know, you do a project and you'll be making a couple cassette masters, couple, you know, maybe a few CD masters. And, you know, like I said, maybe the vinyl backups if they need them. And then you got to do the vinyl parts too. So,
boy, well, that was where mastering facilities actually made all their money, because that was
production.
Yeah.
Many times I just go home and the birds are chirping, you know.
Yeah.
Just coming back in a couple more hours, you know, and doing it all again.
So you don't think of mastering like that either, do you?
Yeah. Yeah. No. It's like, and then you got the guys mastering, they're cranking it out. They're doing two albums a day, maybe, you know, mm-hmm. you know, maybe 12 hours, 14 hours a day. These guys are just mastering away, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a much busier time.
I remember the transition when it went from vinyl and everybody had a lathe to when they first started to do digital, and everybody was afraid of it. And the editing was clunky because it was on 1630s and everything. And
yeah, I mean, I didn't do too much tape editing. You know, I came in on the cusp of when digital was kicking in, like 1630, 1610, 1630 DATs. You know, our CD burners to burn CD refs, I think we had one of the first ones by Yamaha, and it wouldn't even cut over 40 minutes. We had to, you know, split the ref up on two discs.
Wow.
Yeah. So
it was really expensive too, and I remember that the blanks were expensive.
Everything was, then, because it was so new. They were still trying to figure out, you know, how to cost effective, you know, make a CDR that can be, you know, a throwaway, so to speak, without having to press it up.
Yeah.
You know. Well, they figured it out, you know. Now we can put over 80 minutes on them.
Yeah, right.
You know, but we don't get many requests for CDs anymore, even refs, you know. So it's changed.
Okay, so you're a future disc, and you have three great mastering engineers to learn from.
Yeah.
What did you learn from them? Did they take you under their wing and show you things, or was it just by osmosis from being around all the time? Or how did
I used to go in after when I had times, and you know, if I saw a record that I really would like to get in on and say, hey, man, let me see what these guys are doing. You know, I would just run it down and then compare it to theirs. I can also look at their EQ, but that would be kind of cheating for me. You know, I didn't want to just do that. So I would do my own thing and then A-B it, you know, and just shake my head and go, man, these guys, man, they've been doing it a long time. They know exactly what to do, you know. I kept doing that until I got my chops down, you know, and then I started getting sessions, you know, once, you know, mm-hmm. Steve or Eddie or Tom, they said, yeah, man, he's got what it takes, you know, to mm-hmm. do this. So they can, you know, whatever overflow was coming across, you know, we can get it out and still, you know, keep the customer happy, you know?
Yeah.
Service industry, you know.
But Eddie kind of took you under his wing though.
Yeah. I mean, I was looking up to him more than the other two guys. Not saying that those guys were great. I just really dug the clientele that was going in his studio. Yeah. So, and I would just, man, let me see what this does, you know. And I'd started asking him questions on, you know, how do you get this punch and all this and that out of this, you know, out of your compressor, or what are you using? Is it EQ? You know, and mm-hmm. he'd share all that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
and that was back in the days of everything was outboard when you were doing it.
Yeah.
So a lot of it's analog.
He actually had a Weiss digital console too, and he was quasi analog and digital.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, you know, you're looking at these little moves he's doing and you're like, okay, you know, wow, man.
Yeah.
It takes a little bit of concentration to get that, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I mean,
well, I can remember going in and talking to him when I had my office with you guys over in Ventura Boulevard, and he'd be in there doing something and I'd be talking to him and it was like I wasn't even there. He would be just so concentrated on what he was doing, and
yeah,
he'd go, yeah, mm-hmm.
Focused, right? Hyper focused.
Hyper focused, yeah.
That's what Natasha says now. She'll walk in in the room here, and she'll like wave her hands at me, and she goes, "You really don't have peripheral vision, do you?" And
yeah.
I'm like, sorry, you know, you scare me, and I'm going to jump out of the seat, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so now we move up to Oasis. So Eddie decides he's going to leave Future Disc and start his own place, and it's Oasis Mastering, and you go with him.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have a choice, you know, because of the way the circumstances were, you know. Yeah, so, and that was it. We didn't look back, you know.
Yeah, it was smoking from the day open.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, it was busy right off the bat, man. I mean, we were doing long days, just long days. Yeah, and it was the same grind. And we actually, we had two 1630 systems, and we actually were putting in another one in a production room just to keep it going, you know, keep this way we didn't kill ourselves off the bat, you know, because it's our first year. And we weren't too sure how things were going to go, you know? And, you know, there's always a little bit of this and that you got to deal with. But, you know, it was pretty much a Swiss watch, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, it worked really well.
Yeah, yeah. Good clients right out the bat, too, you know? So I think one of the first records was Change the World by Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
One of the bigger ones that came in there.
There was lots of them, and
yeah, you know. Yeah, yeah. I was trying to remember the like some of the earlier ones.
I bet it's even hard to remember a lot of them.
Man, it's so yeah.
I walk down the halls here and I see all the gold and platinum albums that are hanging, you know, in every space that you can think of, and it's like, oh yeah, I forgot that one came through here.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. You know, sometimes I look, you know, too, and I'm just like, okay, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is you guys were one of the first mastering houses to really go all digital and really get your arms around it and decide, okay, maybe we don't need any analog in the signal path.
I think so, and I think that was because of you when you hopped on UAD, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
you did, right? You hopped on UAD, and I think you introduced us to it, and we really, really liked it a lot, you know? And I think we were mixing it in up to about 2006. And then once we moved to our new facility, we switched over just because, I mean, I really showed Ed, I go, Ed, let's really listen to a true comparison, you know, let's do this, you know, musically, not scientifically, you know? So we set it all up and did a comparison, and you know, we had a really good, still have a good analog console, but we just heard a little bit more impact keeping it digital. And to us, you know, you can't get that back once you do the conversion. So we just decided to stay that way, you know, and we're pretty happy, you know, cause there's a lot of plugins that you can get really good analog sounds now. You know, it's really changed from when it first came out with all this. It was very digital sounding, and now it has this analog warmth and the things that everybody loves about analog. That's available now today, because we were really picky at what we were using. We used it, you know, the CubeTech VPIs, you know, and they were really, I still use them today, you know, and, you know.
And CubeTech, that's something that if you're not into mastering, you wouldn't know about.
Yeah, you just won't know about it, you know, it's just a la carte plugins.
And expensive too.
Expensive, yeah. Yeah.
What are some of the go-to plugins that you use?
I like the CubeTech VPIs, and I'm using this Hoffa. I've been using Hoffa now for, I think, three and a half years, and I'm using the IQ EQ. It's a EQ with it's a dynamic EQ, and it does compression, expansion, has all the cool EQ curves. and it's got a great sound. It's real neutral, you know. I tend to have an I like neutral. You know, I like to have the mixers put their stamp on it, and I don't really want to change it too much. That, you know, from what they do, you know, I don't want to throw a heavy bass sounding compressor on there or something that's really going to squash it down. So, you know, I like neutral, clean, and I also use UAD. That's pretty much it. UAD.
Which ones? Which UAD?
I use the it's the Cambridge in the UAD package.
Yeah.
The EQ and the multiband compressor that they have, the mastering multiband compressor. I use the EQ too. Yeah, from there.
I got some great stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's like an original package they created back in probably in 2006 when we first got it. Maybe it's been around that long, you know, the Precision series.
Yeah, it's hard to beat, that's for sure.
You know, when something sounds good, you just go with it, you know.
Now, what's interesting, when I come in here and I watch you work, you've gone away from using limiters, and instead you use a whole bunch of compressors to do the same thing, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, if I get a crackle or something, I can fix it later, you know, but I like to keep the impact, you know, and I want excitement. And most limiters are just, you know, they tend to squash things because everybody wants things so crazy loud, you know, apparently loud. They want as much level as they can get. Instead of turning up the volume, you know, they're competing constantly.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, as soon as you put a limiter on there, man, I just don't like the way it sounds. That's all. What it does.
And you've tried a bunch of them.
I got five, you know, that in my chain. But, you know, whichever ones I use, you know, I use them very subtle. Sometimes I have to use them, you know, so I just go with it.
Now, the other thing I noticed is you're much less worried about a digital over anymore.
Yeah, I mean, hey, little distortion's good.
Yeah, you know? But nobody complains, right?
No one can hear it, and if it's audible, I'll fix it. You know, I mean, it's not everything's terribly distorted. You know, it's like you got to have taste. You know, when it comes to that, and I mean, I QC everything I work on very low. It's easier to hear the crackles when the volume is just cracking. Like just barely, that's when they just pop out, you know, and instead of, if it's loud, you can't hear it at all. It just goes right by you.
Yeah. So when you hear those crackles, you go in, you fix them individually then?
I fix them. Yeah. Sometimes I'll lay a pass in with a limiter and I'll just cut around the little spot and I'll just go through the song and fix them all.
Oh, just on those clips then?
Yeah. And it's like, it's about nothing's really too long when there's a crackle. If it's a guitar solo, maybe I'll cut the whole thing in. You know, it sounds really close, you know.
So it seemed like there was a trend for a while that the whole competitive level thing was maybe calming down a little bit and people weren't as crazy, but you're not seeing that. You're seeing crazy volumes coming in, right?
Yeah, it hasn't changed.
Even
the mixers come in loud, you know, and I gotta question them sometimes, you know, and I usually call the mixer up, and they're kind enough to print it without the limiter for me, you know, so
you ask them to turn it down.
Yeah, they do it all the time. Yeah,
because I see some of it comes in and it's just crushed, and it's like, what else can you do, right?
Yeah. It's from the start, so we get them to back it down, and we go from there. You know, on the mixer's side, I don't know if they know where everything's being funneled. You know, I don't know if they know if it's going to a reputable mastering engineer. You know, so maybe that's why they do it on their own.
Oh yeah. So, because it used to be the producers or the engineers that select the mastering engineer, and now it's more the record label. So you don't know, right?
You don't. Yeah.
As a mixer, you know, or a producer, you don't know what's going to happen.
I mean, and I don't see the mixer's name on the files unless I recognize some initials from, you know, my, some of my clients, they put their initials on there. Some just come over and I'm like, okay, who mixed this?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, sounds pretty good. Or I need to contact somebody, you know.
Is it different? Do you get different mixes? Well, I'm sure you do, but what are the differences that, of the mixes that you get from, let's say, the older classic guys who have been around as opposed to some of the younger mixers?
It could be the levels that are, they print at. Those guys, the older, more experienced guys, still leave enough headroom. And their balance is, it seems like they're a little smoother, darker, balanced a little better.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these newer guys, you know, they're good, but maybe they're a little bit more exciting, a little pushing the edge, you know, putting a snare way up high just mm-hmm. for more excitement. I mean, it's different, you know, it's just mm-hmm. a different thing.
Balances then.
Yeah, balances, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
See, I wouldn't have expected that actually. What is the biggest problem you see for mixes that are coming in that aren't quite right?
A lot of it is the bit rate.
Really?
Yeah, I get a lot of 16-bit files that are just like mastered already or have a limiter on it. And I question it. I go, is this correct? Is this the right mix? That's a lot of it, really.
Wow.
That happens daily.
I wouldn't have expected that.
It does, yeah.
You think that everybody kind of knows that.
You think, you know?
Yeah.
You think so.
And what's the sample rate that you mostly get in?
I want to say 44/124. I get 48/24 a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say 44/124 is the most common.
I'm shocked.
Yeah.
I'm shocked. I mean, first of all, it seems like everybody that I know is at 96K, but of course.
I get 96. Yeah. Yesterday I had an 88.2 session. All the way through, perfect, you know.
Which makes no sense to me, unless you're going to do a CD, but yeah. I bet there weren't, right? Yeah. If they do a CD, it's one thing, but if they don't.
Yeah, I don't ask. I can capable of converting it, so.
Yeah.
But I think 48/24 is a good starting point, you know. And then, you know, minimum for me. I think that was the best one when I was A-Bing. You know, 48/24 seemed... I can hear everything. It's defined. Once you get to 96, you know, it's, to me, it could be a wash, you know.
You know, quite a number of years ago, I did the tests with multiple different machines where we recorded the same thing at 48K, 96, and 192. And it was mostly natural sounding stuff. It was acoustic guitars and percussion and pianos and stuff like that. The difference between 48 in 96 wasn't all that great. You can hear it, but it wasn't all that great. But the difference between 48 and 192 was astounding. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really was, you know, a live Remembrex moment where you go, I can't tell, you know, is it the real person out there or not? And this wasn't recently.
Right.
This is, you know, a while ago. So I've always thought that, okay, 192, when we get there, that'll be pretty good. That'll be a big step. But we don't seem to be getting there. That's the funny part. I don't see any movement at all.
I know.
That way. But you get a 192 session every now and then, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And sometimes they're older transfers, you know, and you scratch your head, you know, why it's so high, you know. But I think it's to future-proof it, you know.
Yeah.
So.
You mean off the analog master?
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Do you get much analog in?
No, this year it was all digital. I mean, last year I had a few analogs. I had a cassette session this year. So, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I had a cassette session. Two cassette sessions. Yep. So, older punk stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was just masters were living on cassettes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, whatever works.
It was rough. It was rough. It was a rough one.
Noisy?
Just not well recorded, you know. Just you could tell it was like demo style.
Oh, got it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So.
So you do stuff like that all the way up to like Lady Gaga and Ellie Goulding and some really popular artists. What's the difference when you get somebody that's like a superstar? What's the difference in what you have to do or what the demands are?
I just got to make the client happy. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that's it.
Now, who's the client at that point? Is it just the label or are you here from the artist?
Label and the artist.
Yeah.
Artists, you know, artists may not come in, but you know they're listening to it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And, you know, you get the feedback, the revisions, you know, whatever needs to happen or it's good to go, you know.
Do you get more revisions in a situation like that than normal?
No, it's all the same.
Yeah.
You know, I give options. When I master, I always give one or two, maybe three sometimes, you know. It's nice. It's a nice thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's like one will be brighter, one will be darker, one will be louder, one will be softer, you know. One will have more bass.
Well, that will stop the revisions, if nothing else.
Well, it puts their, you know, I usually do that with maybe one song and it sets up, if it's an album, it sets up which direction we're going to go in,
mm-hmm.
you know. I don't overwhelm, though. You know, I don't like to overwhelm.
Yeah, too many choices is no good either.
Exactly, yeah. You know.
Is everything MFIT now as well? You do MFIT masters?
Yeah, for the most part, everyone's getting a digital release of some sort, regardless if it's MFIT or if whatever they're going to, how they're going to send it out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And how much do you do that's intended for CDs?
Usually all the major labels will do a CD.
Mm-hmm.
Indies, not so much, but occasionally, yes, you know, they're going to do a CD release.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't have a percentage wise, you know, but all the majors pretty much, you know, unless it's digital only, you know, they'll tell us, but it's pretty much getting released CD.
And how about vinyl?
Same thing. I mean, indies like vinyl too, you know, they always like, get these three songs on vinyl, you know, or mm-hmm. their EP on vinyl. And I'm like, yeah, it's doable. You know, let me know. But, you know, it's more, indies will do that more often than make a CD
mm-hmm.
release.
And how do you prep a vinyl master then? What do you do differently for it?
I usually back down on the level, you know.
Yeah.
I don't send them the CD level because I know it's too loud from, you know, working in back in the day when vinyl was really popular and seeing what these guys were doing when they were cutting vinyl. I didn't cut it so much, you know, as I hung out and watched a lot of it. And I know where the levels need to be. You know, it has to be realistic, like you're printing to analog tape almost.
Yeah.
You know, so.
How are you getting most of the files these days?
We transfer, or you know, sometimes we'll when they're attended, they just bring them in.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, you know, it's through some cloud base.
So it's no more FTP, because I remember you're one of the first places that had an FTP.
We have one, but it's not used as much. They're sent in through like We Transfer.
Okay.
Or
Dropbox.
Dropbox,
or
yeah.
Yeah.
Dropbox, a lot of Dropboxes, We Transfer. Sometimes we'll go to a Mixer's FTP server.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we have our own. If we have a, you know, somebody that needs to use it, we'll set up, you know, a folder for them. They can drop their files in there and get them back. So.
Yeah. And now when you're sending to pressing plants, it's all file. It's all DDP master, right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah, it's easy.
Yeah, the days of FedEx are
right.
It's gone. The master and making sure it's out by 5 for FedEx.
Yeah, our FedEx guy doesn't even stop here anymore.
Yeah,
so I know
everything's changed so much in mastering. It's a way different business than it used to be.
I know.
I don't think people realize
it's streamlined now.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, it's so. Yeah, the surprise factor is like not there, you know, like the rush. If you need to meet a deadline, it's so much easier now because it's faster to do, you know. You can just send those files, you know, if they have to go to Japan or Korea or New York or, you know, somewhere in LA, you know.
Yeah.
It's just faster, anywhere.
Yeah, 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 right. Well, cool. Let's talk about your monitors for a second, because these are very unique, and I know you've been listening to them for, what, 15 years now?
Isn't it 20?
Is it 20?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess it is, yeah.
Yeah, it's 20. Long. 20 years, yeah. They're the Tannoy Dual 15s. Got the extended super tweeter, hothouse amps, and custom subsystem.
Dual 15s on each side.
Yeah,
yeah.
Dual 15s. You know, the room, got to move air, you know, with some of these, you know, some of these hip-hop clients you have, you know. You got to be able to, you know, let them feel it sometimes, you know, when they're sitting in the sweet spot.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like a TAD system where it's just going to rip your head off. It's going to play a lot lower in SPL, but it's going to sound pretty amazing.
Yeah, you know, that's what I've noticed with all really good big systems is they never sound loud. They sound big, and they kind of envelop you. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking for loud, it's very
painful.
It sneaks up on you. You know, a system like this, it sneaks up on you. It's not. It's louder than you think, than you feel.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds pretty damn good.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to complain. It's a giant microscope.
But you don't listen loud, though, relatively speaking.
No.
I mean, you have a loud and soft level, but your loud isn't really as loud as other people.
It's not that loud. Nope. It's just I know it's there if it needs it, you know, if I need to check something. Sometimes you work on some records that the bottom end's not balanced right. You turn it up, you know, mm-hmm. until you could clean it up.
Yeah.
Bring it down. Good volume. Nice, my normal listening level, and then, you know, listen to it again, make sure it's not too thin.
Yeah. So. How long does it take you, if you're going to do an album, how long does the first song take you?
Getting set up, probably like a half an hour,
mm-hmm.
get that first track. You know, once I get that going, it's roughly, you know, 15 to 20 minutes if it's the same mixer doing the whole record. You know, it's going to be consistent.
Yeah.
You know.
It's compilation. It's way different, yeah.
Yeah, when you're getting records from all different mixers and you're trying to make it sound pretty cohesive, there's some time to take, you know. It changes. It's a little bit different than, you know, each song could take half an hour, you know.
Last question. What's the best piece of business or music advice that you got from somebody along the way, or maybe something you learned yourself?
I want to say it's dealing with mastering. Balance is the key.
Yeah.
Balance, you know, stick to your guns, right? When something's right, it's right. That was the biggest thing, you know, getting to understand that, you know. I mean, when you're just a skosh too much, it's wrong, you know. Like, you think you want to brighten this up, you know, or put a little bottom on here. It's just, you know, you can't overdo things.
Mm-hmm.
Right is right. Sometimes you just have to leave things alone, you know, for what I do, you know.
But again,
it's the key, though, because it plays on all formats that way, you know.
But
so
that's what, you know, that people that are doing their own mastering and trying to do their own mastering, they don't know, and they tend to go way overboard.
Exactly. It's like, yeah, I mean, moderation, you know. It's like you need experience to do it is what it is when it comes down to it. And that's what I learned, you know, just from my engineers that I worked with and listening to all those music, QCing a lot of records for Sony. You know, it's just like, got a lot of experience just listening to music, you know, and balance. And that's what it is, you know. It's balance, just knowing that. I mean, we get the impact here, you know, with gain gain stages, you know, that's what makes the record crack, you know, but having the balance is the key.
To find out more about Gene and Oasis, go to oasismastering.com. That's one word, oasismastering.com. Thanks for listening and being my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, you can go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.